Rafters 10-4 last night. The Kingfish meet the Rockford Riveters tonight at Simmons Field at 6:35. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Thursday, June 14th. Sunny and very warm. Today's high heading 483. This morning, wind is from the west at 4, humidity down to 72%, 66 degrees now in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from UW Parkside, now offering the Sports Management Master's Degree Program. Students learn the business skills necessary to succeed in today's competitive sports environment. Flexible degrees for in-demand careers. More at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Happy to have with me in the studios Nan Calvert. Sad that our other guest, at least thus far, is not with us, namely Dave Giordano, who is the head of Root Pike Wind. That is the Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network. And we're hoping Dave is still on the way. Nan, I'm remembering that in our email exchange, we had a slight little snafu when it came to the date.
Yes.
And so it
but
made.
We cleared that up.
We thought we cleared that up, but maybe not completely. But at any rate, we are hoping that Dave is on the way and that we'll be able to join us before the end of the hour. But in the meantime, otherwise, Nan knows a fair amount about, first of all, about water and the watershed, and certainly knows a lot about Root Pike Wind and the good work that they have been doing over the years. So we will certainly have a worthwhile conversation no matter what, but we hope Dave's going to be part of it here before too long.
Yes. I'll do the best I can.
We've been in this predicament at least once before.
Yes.
in your history of helping us here on the Morning Show. So this is actually a nice opportunity to talk about a couple of basics that are extremely important. And I suspect that there are listeners listening to us right now who actually probably have only the vaguest notion, if they have any notion at all, of, for instance, what we mean by a watershed. What is, in general, a watershed? And then, specifically then, what are we talking about when we talk about the Root Pike watershed?
Mm-hmm. So there are very few people who understand that everyone lives in a watershed. Everyone lives in a watershed.
No matter where you are.
No matter where you are, you live in a watershed. And a watershed is where the majority of your water drains to. And so envision it as if our communities are not divided up by streets or municipalities, but rather they are defined by where the water goes. And by water, I mean stormwater runoff, rain, snowmelt, dew, all that sort of thing. And because of topography, it will run to the lowest point and collect somewhere. So you might live in the Lake Michigan watershed. So most of the water runs to Lake Michigan. You might live in the Root River area, and so it goes primarily to the Root River. Perhaps you live in the Pike River area, and it goes to that area. And so because of their proximity and other and geography and topography and all those sort of things, it's the Root Pike watershed. Perhaps you live in the Fox River watershed. All of those kinds of things, it's going to drain to a body of water. Now, of course, over the history of humans, we have changed the topography of places. We have drained wetlands, and we've flattened things out tremendously. And so that does interrupt, to a degree, the watershed. And, of course, we've also paved over a great deal of the surface area of the earth, which changes how the water goes back into the earth and certainly how it flows over the earth. But still in all, despite all of those challenges that we've set forth, we all live in a watershed. And so you can imagine when water is going over all of the roads and the sidewalks, it's running off of buildings, it's coming off of farm fields and lawns and parking lots and all of those things, it picks up things along the way. And many of those things are pollutants. They're toxins, so they can be petrochemicals, they can be herbicides and pesticides and fertilizers and even organic matter like leaves and soil and all that sort of thing. And it drains into that watershed. And so because there's such heavy pressure on our waterways, on our watershed, and ultimately on water quality, we now have to become acutely aware of how we treat that. And historically, we've treated stormwater runoff as an annoyance. We've treated it as something that is a waste product, something that just has to be shushed off into the magic land of away. And of course, there is no magic land of away. So at this point now, it's a sort of a day late and a dollar short, if you will, to begin treating stormwater runoff differently. And so that is what Root Pike Watershed Initiative is all about. How are we addressing our watersheds? How are we protecting those watersheds? How are we improving the watersheds in which we all live? And there are so many things that we can do as individuals and certainly as communities as well.
Before we get into some of that and maybe get into even some specifics about the problems that are in place, I want to understand something better. It sounds like nature has created these watersheds. And I notice on the website for Root Pike Win that they make reference to, for instance, the Root Pike Basin.
Mm-hmm, right.
So in many cases, we're talking in a sense about a topographical basin.
Right.
And it makes sense visually, then within a basin, everything flows towards, in a sense, the drain at the middle. So,
yeah.
So that's what nature intended. It sounds like what you're saying is that much of what we have built, much of what we have constructed is, in a sense, counter to the watershed, or I mean, interrupts what otherwise would sort of naturally and most healthfully occur. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, absolutely. And if it's easier to think of a watershed as a basin, I would encourage people to do that. It's a low-lying area because water flows downhill rather than uphill, usually. Anyway, that's where your water goes. And yes, we have endeavored to flatten everything out because it's more convenient. There's that ugly word again, more convenient and easier for us to do things. So in a sense, then, we have slowed down the natural processes. We have interrupted the natural processes of water runoff. And when you really think about it, many, many, many years ago, before everything was flattened, before wetlands were drained, before everything was covered over with impervious surface, very little snowmelt and rainfall actually ran off straight away into our waterways, into the watersheds, because it had an opportunity to infiltrate back down underground into the underground aquifers where it's supposed to go. And when water flows underground past plant roots and soil particles and all of those kinds of things, it is filtered and cleaner when it goes back down underground. It doesn't pick up all of those things that are on the surface. And then it goes back down into the underground waterways and eventually bubbles up somewhere along the way in the watershed and back out to the surface in a little rivulet, a stream, a pond, a lake, and so on and so forth. But we interrupted that because we've drained so many wetlands, and we've interrupted the flow of streams and ponds and rivers, and so now we're left with the backlash. And of course, the backlash is a lot of flooding and water that runs off in a high volume and at high velocity and causes us lots of headaches.
Mm. I know that at least on one occasion we've had a conversation about Root Pike Wynn in the immediate wake of a huge downpour here in southeastern Wisconsin.
Right.
I mean, sometimes on a sunny day like this and during what's been a relatively dry period, this might not seem like the foremost of concerns, but we can well remember those occasions. And it seems like we're living in an era now where when we have storms, we have ferocious storms.
Ferocious storms.
And so what you're saying is that if we have done things to, in a sense, disable the natural process of the watershed, then we are likely to be running into some urgent issues and some urgent problems.
Right. You know, it was just last year in the summertime that the city of Burlington flooded tremendously. You couldn't even tell where the roads began and ended. There were fish in the streets. One of the bank vaults flooded. And so it's true that we do have these storms that seem to have a much, much greater impact on us than they did in previous years.
For those of you just joining us, you're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. And we have with us Nan Calvert, and shortly we will have Dave Giordano, who is with Root Pike Wynn, the Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network. So we have been talking in these first few minutes about just in kind of the basics of what is a watershed. And, you know, that image, Nan, of the Root Pike Basin, that's probably helpful, but it's also underscores the fact that, you know, none of us feel like we live in a basin. I mean, there's nothing just as we look out the window. I mean, it's in a sense, it's too large a basin or too subtle a basin for that to be immediately apparent to the naked eye. And that's part of why a group like Root Pike Wynn and conversations like this are important, to get people understanding about something they live right in the middle of, but in a sense can't really see.
Right. We're not taught that. You know, when we go to school, we're taught how to navigate our streets and our towns and cities and our neighborhoods and that sort of thing. But we don't learn a lot of that from very early on. We don't learn about the non-human-made things that really make up our world and affect every single thing that we do. We mostly learn about the human constructs of it. And it would be wonderful, especially because we live so close to Lake Michigan. And certainly lots of us live close to the Root River, the Pike River, the Fox River, and we have wonderful wetlands in and around southeastern Wisconsin. Everyone who listens to WGTD really is kind of a hop, skip, and a jump from some sort of water. It would be wonderful if we could spend a lot more hands-on time learning about those things and experiencing it and really begin to understand how that affects us and how we're part of it.
Right. Ahead of us talking more specifically about Root Pike Wind, which we will do with Dave, I wonder, Nan, if you have some sense of whether or not groups like Root Pike Wind exist in other places. I mean, is this a conversation that is happening in a fairly widespread fashion across the country, across America, and in other parts of the world for that matter? Or, as far as you can tell, are we relatively exceptional in giving this kind of attention to our own watershed and trying to do better in terms of safeguarding it?
I think that Wisconsin as a whole stands out because we have a legacy of conservation and people who have championed environmental causes for decades and decades. In southeastern Wisconsin especially, there are many, many groups who champion the cause of water quality and watershed issues. You have so many river keepers and the Great Lakes Alliance and all of those kinds of groups, grassroots groups, citizen science groups that monitor the quality of streams and ponds and wetlands in their own neighborhoods. So I would like to think, and I do believe, that Wisconsin is standout in the nation. And, you know, when you think about it, I mean, the city of Racine, I forget what year it was, but, you know, our drinking water won an award. I mean, that's fairly amazing. I think that when you look at the rest of the country, I think there's an echo out there that reflects that people are slowly becoming more aware of water quality issues. And there are certainly groups, grassroots groups, that spend, you know, hour after hour, day after day, cleaning garbage out of rivers, trying to reclaim water quality, not only for the citizens who live along those waterways, but also the non-human citizens of those waterways, both plants and animals. It's always a long, slow, uphill climb. Anything environmental is a long, slow, uphill climb. And there's never, ever, ever any money for it.
Right.
But, you know, there are people out there working tirelessly to improve things.
So I know that when it comes to this particular area, probably where you have the most significant expertise is when it comes to certain plants. That can play a really significant role, very, very positive role in this, in the way that the watershed works. So first of all, explain what the connection is, in a sense, sort of physically, between certain plants and watershed and water runoff.
Well, anytime there is bare ground, the water is just going to run off into whatever body of water is closest.
Frantically, quickly.
Or it's going to run into the stormwater sewer system. So native plants are part and parcel of the whole water cycle, and Dave can speak to this as well. Wetland plants and native plants in general have very deep, deep root systems. So they bind the earth together, which is what's supposed to happen. Erosion isn't supposed to happen. And then what happens is that as those root systems senesce or die off each season, it produces channels that go deep underground that the water follows in order to get back down into the underground aquifers. And then, of course, obviously the plants use water in order to sustain their own lives. And then some plants are rather adept at surviving and filtering out toxins. So one of our prettiest wetland plants is our native iris, and it's rather hardy, and it can filter out a lot of toxins. And there are many other native plants, wetland plants, that are fairly good at that as well. So in order to, water quality depends upon what is upland. So if you can prevent things, soil and other particulate matter from getting into our waterways, that's the best, that's one part of the equation, and you do that with primarily really well with native plants. And that's why, you know, many, many years ago, Root Pike Wynn was concerned primarily with working with homeowners and businesses to install stormwater runoff gardens or rain gardens. So taking rooftop runoff and also some pavement runoff and directing it into gardens that were constructed in a certain way and then vegetated with native plants to keep that water from just going directly into the stormwater sewer systems. Instead, it went back down underground. So they were extremely successful for quite a number of years in having those constructed primarily in more suburban and urban areas. And that, you know, that made me think about something you said earlier about this whole idea of watershed. I happened to be working with someone at the time, and I was talking about stormwater runoff gardens or rain gardens, and the person said to me, well, I can't possibly need one of those. I don't live in a watershed. And I said, but you do. And she said, oh, no, I don't live anywhere near water. And I think this was, I don't know, Oak Creek or something like that. And I said, oh, my goodness. That's really an interesting comment, you know.
Wow. That, I mean, that really says a lot. And again, it's the, in a sense, it's not that it's exactly invisible, but it's something that is, in a sense, somewhat imperceptible. I mean, at least on the most sort of basic level. So back to native plants. So what is it about native plants that's so magical as opposed to other plants? I mean, I would just think that, generally speaking, plants would all share the qualities that you were describing, whether they're native or not.
Well, you'd think so.
Right.
But it's not quite that way. So native plants evolved part and parcel with their habitats. And so they are ideally suited to the soil in which they evolved and to the sort of watershed conditions in which they evolved, even those though those conditions have changed dramatically. And certainly they are, I like to think of them as the intercessors between the earth and the sky. They support myriad life forms. And the key to life, obviously, is biodiversity. So when you have a lot of plants, not only that have really deep root structures, but also differently shaped and formed root structures, you can catch on to a lot of water runoff or sheet flow and get it to go back down underground. The other thing is that a good native landscape tends to be dense. Not only is it diverse, but it's dense. And so as a result, there's a microclimate that's created down near the soil surface that slows down evaporation to a certain degree and keeps the soil moist and cooler. So compare that to a parking lot in the summer, an asphalt parking lot, and you can see the shimmering waves of heat coming off of the parking lot. And if you happen to spill something on it, you can see it dry up or evaporate right away. So a native landscape will help to sustain, support, and restore a natural water cycle.
Interesting.
So, you know, it's better to have a diverse landscape. So if you have no native plants, it's a shame. But but if you have something more than lawn, something more than asphalt, something more than cement, it's much better than the alternative. But I would always advocate for native plants, just because not only are they beautiful, but they're also ridiculously functional. More so than non-native plants, more so than horticultural species.
What do you mean functional?
Just in terms of what they do for the environment, what they do for species support, water cycle, nitrogen cycle, all of the cycles that they're involved in.
So they are a contributor to the well-being of the environment in which they're planted.
They are a major player.
Interesting.
Absolutely.
Now, of course, one of the realities of life is that we do need parking lots.
We do.
In which to park our cars.
We do.
I mean, some people would argue we have more parking lots than we need. And, of course, one of the interesting issues right now is that as certain big box stores close, we have some empty stores and basically empty parking lots. And one wonders someday if that land can somehow be reclaimed.
Right.
If at some point we determine that nothing is ever going to go into where that Kmart was.
Right.
So there are never going to be cars parking in this empty parking lot. Should that parking lot at some point be torn up? Should that building be torn down? And should that, in a sense, become green space again? But for places where there simply must be a parking lot, are there ways in which, even in that kind of landscape, so to speak, something can be done so it's not quite so harmful?
Absolutely. And, you know, even in your scenario where a store has been abandoned and the parking lot is no longer used, what are we going to do? Are we going to tear it up? Are we going to try and reclaim the land? You know, when you think of that, that's extremely difficult. This land has been stripped. It's been intensely compacted. It's had all kinds of stuff piled on top of it. It has had perhaps decades of cars parking on it, compacting it even further. So what has that done to the subsoil layer? It's, you know, that would be a really interesting thing to find out. I don't know, but I'm certain it's probably not particularly positive. So to bring that soil back into production would take quite a bit of work. I'm certain that it could be done. But even so, in existing parking lots or parking lots that are going to be built, there are so many things that we could do differently. So many positive forward-moving things that we could do differently that would not only positively impact water quality issues, but certainly work to mitigate that whole heat island effect that parking lots represent. So one of the things, you know, we all go to parking lots and there are these tiny little raised islands where trees are struggling. And, you know, and so instead of making them raised islands and making them so small, build them down. In other words, make them a swale. Make it so that it's a basin and plant it up with some native plants. Make it big enough to sustain a good native canopy tree so that water runs into those basins. It may or may not have to be bioengineered. In other words, there may have to be some filtration devices under there, because most of us don't realize how many petrochemicals end up on parking lot surfaces. Not only petrochemicals, but people who dump out their ashtrays and, you know, all of those kinds of things that end up there. We may have to employ mechanical means of filtering out the pollutants that end up in there. But it would certainly go a long way to re-engineer our thinking in terms of how to build parking lots and how much more beautiful it would be in the long run. When you think about wind control and you think about, you know, snowdrift control and all of those things, re-engineering them so that they have vegetative basins all over them would be just terrific. And then in the outlots along parking lots, instead of just plain old retention basins that are lined with turf grass and mown no matter what, why don't we vegetate those? Why don't we make those sort of, if you will, reclaimed, so to speak, or human-made wetland areas? Fill those up with plants that can assist with returning stormwater runoff back down underground. There's so many things that we can do. Rethinking surfaces of parking lots that are rather not completely impervious to water. You know, there are so many things that can be done, but unfortunately, we just keep doing the same things over and over and over again And we keep getting the same results, and now the results are coming back to haunt us.
Right. So it sounds like one of the inroads that needs to continue to be made and be made better and better if we possibly can is to get involved in the process of construction.
Right.
And be speaking to and influencing those who are making decisions about where things are going to be constructed and how they are going to be constructed.
Right.
I mean, that's part and parcel to making significant progress here.
Right.
So are there places to which you can point as success stories in this respect? I mean, are there examples right here in southeastern Wisconsin, or do we need to look further away to see places where this has been done in the way that you've described?
There are places in southeastern Wisconsin, and of course I don't have the names with me at the moment, which is okay. But yes, there are places in southeastern Wisconsin that have done cutting-edge, innovative things with construction. These things can then be scaled down to residential applications. You know, a long time ago, probably in the 70s, that seems like a long time ago, doesn't it? But it actually wasn't very long ago. There was a product that was made out of cement, but it was lattice work. So you imagine the wooden lattice work that people use. But it was made out of cement, and instead of paving over your driveway, you put this lattice work down so that vegetation could grow up in the openings. If you wanted to mow it, you could. If you needed to, sometimes it was just moss in between, but you know, it was easy to drive over, it was easy to snow blow, it was easy to shovel, and yet water could infiltrate back down underground. Wouldn't that be wonderful if we could have more of that? And it didn't seem so far-fetched, it didn't seem so quote-unquote alternative. It would be a wonderful method. You know, I live in a more rural area, a lot of us have gravel driveways, but many of our municipalities require us to either cement or pave it over. But why is that?
Right.
It works counterintuitively nowadays.
So that kind of thing is worth revisiting and perhaps changing. And you're, of course, also touching on the fact that this is a problem that is not just created by parking lots in cities.
No.
This is also a problem that is also aggravated by certain practices of certain farmers and
right.
others who live in rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
We are all in this together.
We are all in this together.
Speaking of together, we have Dave Giordano with us now, head of Root Pike Wind.
Yay!
Glad you're here.
Thanks very much for having me.
So in the time that remains, we have some things to explore. In the opening, Nan really did a nice job of describing what a watershed is, how they operate in general, and about some of the issues that have risen here in southeastern Wisconsin and in other places. Maybe we could just take a couple of moments to talk about some of the specifics that I was noticing on your on the website for Root Pike Wind in terms of some of the specific issues that are of specific concern that have not come up today in what Nan was talking about. For instance, we have to be thinking about phosphorus and nitrogen from runoff. Where do we tend to see that the most?
Well, right now our watershed is mainly impaired from agricultural practices as well as stream bank erosion. And this is no dig against the farmers. They put food on our table, but it is the reality, and that's backed up by significant studies that our group has done, and that's prevalent throughout the Midwest. So phosphorus and nitrogen in normal amounts are actually part of normal processes, natural processes. But when you have an excess amount of phosphorus and nitrogen from things like decaying farm fields and stream bank erosion, which sediment contains a lot of phosphorus, you know, when that starts to aggregate and it pumps through our streams and into Lake Michigan, that essentially interrupts or accelerates some of the processes that are negative and that have big impacts on our submergent vegetation as well as aquatic species.
Mm. In addition to some other things that we talked about that are mentioned on your website, you talk at some length about chloride, particularly, of course, now it's June, but much of the rest of the year we are busy salting our roads because of snow and ice. Explain why this can be a very detrimental factor in our watershed's health.
Yeah, I start out by saying, you know, we don't have any saltwater fish in Wisconsin. So the more salt we're putting into our rivers and streams and into Lake Michigan, the more we impair their ability to live, quite frankly. So there have been tests done in our area of the watershed where the chloride levels are at saltwater levels. And, you know, again, this is the delicate dance that we partake in, and that is, where do we find solutions? Where do we go out for technology, best practices, where we strike a balance? We're not suggesting at all that, you know, we can't use salt anymore. I think that's just not a reality. But can you go through the process of putting best practices together where maybe that salt truck isn't spinning its wheel, its auger at a stoplight and dumping a couple extra pounds on that intersection? And every little bit counts. And so that's part of what our group does. Yeah, we try to find those win-win situations that cost the municipalities money if they're wasting salt, right? So the efficient use of salt is a big deal. And what many people don't realize is salt is not regulated. So there's different kinds of salt products out there, and those salt, there's certain salts that work at certain temperatures. Many of the salt products out there don't work below 15 degrees. So if you're out there at 10 below and you're putting salt on it, it will take a long time for that salt that ice and snow to even melt. So I think the best thing you can do is really, you know, it's funny to talk about salt and snow in June, but is to try to get your driveways shoveled and your snowblower out as soon as possible. Get all that snow off as soon as you can before it turns to ice.
Right. So there isn't the need to lay down salt, which in effect can be one more nasty contributor to the situation we were talking about. And we also had not gotten to talking about the whole matter of pet waste and the fact that people need to be really important, attentive to this and not disposing of their pet waste improperly.
Right. Yeah. Pet waste is, believe it or not, it's a big deal. You know, pre-settlement, you had animal populations certainly that were, you know, depositing their excrement in certain numbers. But there's studies now done that the amount of pets in any given square mile in a residential or a municipal area far exceeds those pre-settlement numbers. So you're getting a lot more volume of that. And if it's not being picked up and there's no way for those natural processes to kind of break down that stuff, then guess what? It's in our rivers and streams. It's in Lake Michigan. It flows up on our beaches. Our beaches close. Our municipalities, their brand suffers. You know, we're not in this just for habitats and flood prevention and water quality, which are obviously very important things. But, you know, our little group here has we have a lot of pride in this community, and we want to make sure the community brand is strong. Those things hurt the brand, and that's why we work with municipalities a lot to improve those situations.
We're speaking with Dave Giordano, who's joined us, the head of Root Pike Win, the Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network. So, Dave, in the few minutes that remain, it probably would make sense for us to talk about the entrance of Foxconn, the potential entrance of Foxconn into southeastern Wisconsin, and what something like that can potentially mean for instance, the Root Pike Watershed. And the kind of concerns that have already been raised and further questions that probably should be posed. First of all, does Root Pike Win have, in a sense, an official position when it comes to Foxconn?
Yeah, our position with Foxconn is our position that we have with any other landowner, municipality, stakeholder, and that is we're trying to find the win-win. We feel like that's the best approach, where we find out what their goals are. We look at our goals. Where can we find where that Venn diagram, where that intersection occurs? And I'm happy to say that we've had a number of conversations with Foxconn, and I'm optimistic about what might happen. It's a little early to talk details, but we'll see. Mm-hmm. I am optimistic. From a macro perspective, yes, this development is going to change our landscape. There's no doubt about that. But like I talked about earlier, our major contributing source of pollutants to the watershed is agriculture. Again, nothing against the farmers. It's just the reality.
Right.
So now you're going to take 1,500 acres of farmland out of production, and you're going to put pavement, and that area is actually going to be, it's going to be under tighter regulations than what the farmer is under right now.
Interesting.
So a lot of people don't realize that. Now, we are concerned about the amount of runoff. We haven't been privy to a lot of the numbers, but they will be held to regulatory standards as far as runoff is concerned. How to predict when the next 100 year and 500 year storm is going to happen, and how does that all that water flow off of, 1,500 acres of impervious pavement? That's what the engineers have got to figure out.
Right.
And Foxconn doesn't want their brand to hurt either. They're putting this big development in, and they don't want all the negativity of putting all these adverse impacts on the environment. So
right.
We're optimistic.
And when you say that there have been some, that we have had some conversations with Foxconn, I'm just curious, did you literally mean Root Pike Wynn has had conversations with someone from Foxconn?
Yes.
Oh. I'm reminded of a conversation with Mick Burke, who's a reporter with Racine Journal Times, who's covered this Foxconn story at great length. And one of the things that he mentioned in our conversation is that it is sometimes easy to think of Foxconn, I mean, it's obviously immense, but it's not as though that huge rectangle is one gigantic factory, that in fact the plans are to construct something that will be much more like, in his words, a campus, mm-hmm. and with different structures, with space between those structures. And so in fact, that should be at least some measure of reassurance. By no means should we just not be worried or concerned about anything, but it's probably important when people look at a map and see a big, huge rectangle that says Foxconn on it, that that's not a rectangle that will be just full of concrete and other impervious surfaces. I mean, it's a little more complicated picture than that.
It is. I haven't been privy to all the official plans. But what I will say this, I call it the Foxconn flip, where we're going to take a bunch of agricultural land and we're going to turn it into commercial, residential, and industrial development. The concentric rings of growth that are going to happen around Foxconn are what I'm more concerned about.
Mm.
And so you're talking about literally every square acre that you have available to be able to put some of the practices in that Nan has talked about, whether they're swales, whether it's increasing the riparian buffer between the stream banks, the use of salt, all of those different things. We're going to go from kind of a suburban ag community to a highly urbanized community. And so now we need to bring in all the best practices of an urban community versus an ag community.
Interesting. And of course, the concern is that good choices be made all along the way. And especially at the outset, as plans are being drawn and
right. I will say this too. One of the our niche is we bring people together. We're like a dating service. We bring landowners and municipalities that have issues in the watershed with solutions. We're not always the solution provider, but we at least bring them together. And you'd be surprised at how much common ground there is and how much willingness there is to really get some of these best practices in place. The devil's in the details of, just like anything, but we're the only nonprofit in this area that's serving that niche, and we're proud of it. And we're grateful for the stakeholders in the municipalities, Kenosha County, Summers, City of Kenosha, Mount Pleasant, Racine County, they've all been very, very engaged and have a willingness to collaborate with us.
And I hope, too, just to sort of tag along with what Dave was saying, that if there are any agricultural people listening to this, that perhaps it will make them reflect on how they're approaching their land and how can they raise the bar? How can they do things differently? Maybe the answer isn't monocropping. So, you know, we all have an opportunity to learn here. It's happening, and now, as Dave said, we have to do the absolute best that we can by the land and the watershed.
Right. Dave, does Root Pike Wind have an official position when it comes to the matter of water diversion that has also come up in and around Foxconn?
Well, our official position there would be we'd love to see things stay in a natural state. But we also understand that people need drinking water. So what we would push more for is there's incredible technologies out there. There's so many smart people out there. Wisconsin's a hotbed for water technologies. Hmm. You know, we're optimistic that these groups are going to get together more and solve this issue without having detrimental impacts to the environment. One thing that I've discovered in working in this position is that if you work really hard at finding a win-win situation, if you're willing to listen to the other side and see what they have to say, there's usually some common ground. And so, like with the Waukesha diversion, yes, there will be an increased water flow to the Root River. That actually is kind of a good thing because that watershed suffers from low flows sometimes. Now, the adverse side of it is there's things that they don't have to regulate with regard to microplastics and pharmaceuticals and things like that, where that there's no real regulation on taking that stuff out of the water. Those are the two kind of opposing forces. And again, we want to bring people together to see if they can solve those issues with smarts and technology.
Right. Well, it's certainly something we're all watching with great interest and concern, and it's great to hear the perspective of Root Pike Wind, and good to hear that you have already been a player, certainly a part of the conversation. Can you remind, Dave, how people can contact Root Pike Wind if they want to know more about what you do?
Yeah, great. I mean, the best way to get in contact with our group is just send me an email. It's dave@rootpikewind.org, or visit our website. It's rootpikewind.org. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on all of those things. You know, our group is going to get a lot more active in the next year or so with a membership group and volunteer efforts. So if there's anyone out there in the listening audience that wants to get more involved in our group, we'd love to have you.
Great. Dave, it's great to meet you. Dave Giordano, head of Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network. Nan, you have just over 90 seconds to get your announcements in.
Here we go. I just want to put in a plug for Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network. We show up at people's events, municipal events and other kinds of events. And if you go to the display, you will be treated to an amazing watershed runoff model that shows you in a nutshell what happens when water runs off of different kinds of surfaces. And there's all kinds of educational information, and there's almost always a rain barrel to be had. So do visit Root Pike Wind's display when you're out and about at various and sundry events. Okay, now River Bend is having a full moon paddle on June 27th at 7:30 p.m. All paddling equipment is provided, but if you want to bring your own canoe or kayak or whatever it is that you have, you're more than welcome to do so. You'll be on the Root River, and afterwards, you're going to be enjoying music, s'mores, a campfire, and you can bring your own beverages. $25 for members, $30 for non-members. Registration is absolutely required because River Bend only has a certain amount of watercraft, so do call them and register if you'd like to participate. Hawthorne Hollow is having the Pike River Benefit Concert Series Friday, June 22nd, 6 to 9 p.m., $10 admission, Food, wine, beer, and soda are all available for purchase. I hear it's a wonderful thing to do, so go out and support Hawthorne Hollow. And we'd like to give a shout-out to Pringle Nature Center 20th Anniversary Celebration. Congratulations, Pringle Nature Center. Friday, June 15th, 9 a.m. to